And it's the end of the earth.
We're all dead.
Think about direction, how we go to Abigail now. Stand, it's a fight for the earth.
We're still dead.
Think about the dreams we've been having that we've all seen before. If you are confused, ask what the heck. This is Stephen King. What'd you expect? Your head is going to be in your hands. The story you'll fail to understand. So stand, it's the end of the earth.
We're all dead.
Think about direction, how we go to Abigail now. Stand, it's a fight for the earth.
We're still dead.
Think about the dreams we've been having that we've all seen before.
Sci-Fi Melody, symptom 189. Stand. M-O-O-N. That spells stand.
And welcome back, sickies, to our final episode of Malady March, covering sci-fi films, talking about Contagion in a sick, twisted commemoration of the time when we started going in shelter in place exactly a year ago. And today is also a wondrous occasion because it is a day where we are all in studio. That's right. We are all back together now. So barring any kind of freak mutation of the virus, we are all back together. And man, does it feel good. It's why we were able to do that song with the backup singing. So I don't know about you guys, but I'm jazzed that we're all back in the same room together.
Well, this, you know, should we tell them that we're changing the name of the podcast to Rage Master and the Ragettes?
Oh, yes,
the name
of
our band. It was the debut of Rage Master and the Ragettes.
Yep.
I'm a Ragette.
So, we will come out with the album soon, and you can buy it with 16 easy payments of $19.99.
Now, that's what I call Rage, Volume 9.
So, and that's going to be after the Rage Master Sings. That the Rage Master Sings is a solo album, solo project. But then now that's what I called Rage is going to be starring the Ragettes. So look for that in the sometime future. Same along with that America Asunder podcast that Scott's been working on. Scott's going to be releasing that. Scott will be releasing that sometime in any word on
you
that,
know
Scott?
I might release it before George R. R. Martin finishes the Game of Thrones series.
All right, so never.
It's very possible.
Bet's going either way. I have 50-50 on neither of them getting them out.
So Vegas George, odds are not favorable.
Here's the thing. If George R. R. Martin's health gives out before he releases those books, that means I never release America Asunder.
So
for
those of you people who those of you sickies that actually heard the first two episodes and thought, boy, I'd really like to hear more America Asunder, don't hold your breath. That's essentially what Scott is trying to tell you. Don't hold your breath.
Listen, though, I may get out of this period of malaise that I've been in for the last 2 years on writing and actually pick up where I left off. I think if you listen to episode one of America Asunder, episode zero and episode one, I talk about releasing a new podcast in a week or two.
Yeah, about that.
Ambition, huh?
Get back to those quick rants, too. I got tons of ideas about quick rants.
Like, sure do.
Can everything please just go back to being small, medium, and large? I don't want to decode what a medium is based on whatever your company is. And that's because I went to Cold Stone Creamery. And their sizes are like just enough, party size, mega bowl of fun.
Are you serious? It's called that?
No, I'm making that up. But one of their sizes is just enough.
Oh, that wouldn't.
Wow.
Because I have enough problems with Starbucks's venti, whatever, grande, whatever.
I finally caught up to that. I'm also stuck on Honey Hut's junior and everything else. It's like, okay, can you just say kids?
I just say large or me. I don't care what you are.
Yeah, but what gets really annoying is when they're like, we don't have a medium. You can choose between individual, small family, or large village. Well, I'll take the one in the middle. You got one in the middle, don't you? I just did a rant here, so
So that's just a sampling of what Scott would like to do. If you'd like to do more of that, please leave it in the comments if you'd like to hear more of that. But in the meantime, we are going to finish the month out with 1994 Stephen King's The Stand, which was a four-hour special that stretched across It was aired on TV. I remember this.
ABC, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it was on nightly throughout the week. So Monday through Thursday. And you had to watch it. Or was it every week? I forget exactly that. But it aired in installments. So what you had to do is stick around and watch it. And of course, this was back in the day when, unless you taped it, if you missed an episode, you're hosed.
Listen, kids, you're wondering about tape. See, we had these things called VCRs.
They know what that is.
That took giant plastic cassettes, bigger than your cell phone, even an iPhone XX Max.
Even a tablet sometimes.
And you would put that in the VCR and it could record what was on the TV. But when you played it back, you'd have to adjust this thing called tracking to get the white lines and the skipping out of it.
And heaven forbid that there's any issues with that tape, because then you're screwed.
You took it back to when you rented them from stores, you had to take it back to a thing called Blockbuster. But if you didn't rewind, you got fined.
You actually could buy rewinding machines.
Yes, because people were that lazy.
So for those of you that didn't know that, just, you know, YouTube it.
It's in you'll the before times.
Yeah.
Listen, while you're doing that, look for something called a rotary dial phone.
Also cassette tapes.
Oh, geez. So anyway, this series, by the way, before we get into any of the info about it, let's just... it's a Stephen King thing, and it reminds me of 90s Stephen King TV adaptations. And the weirder and more confusing it is, the more likely Stephen King had a hand in it. Essentially, if there's a good rule of thumb here, if you want to know if this adaptation is anything close to the book, see if Stephen King makes a cameo. If he does, it's close. Because we all know the story, how he loathed Kubrick's The Shining, even though everybody loved it. And then Stephen King made his own version of The Shining, and it was garbage, comparatively speaking.
That
was
might have been the last ABC Stephen King miniseries, too.
It was awful, because it lacked the punch of the Kubrick version. And that, so if you want to know, is this approved by Stephen King? See if he's in it or if he has a writing credit.
And oh, here, he does.
He has he both does. Of those things. This checks off both of those boxes. Now, is this better than the Langoliers? Yes, it is. But I don't know if that's the fault of the actors, the directors, or just the fact that the Langoliers is just much more weird.
See, this is the thing. I would almost say the Langoliers could be butter at times because it is weird.
Well, that's for you. For me, it was
The Langoliers had a plot that made sense, at least.
Yeah, at least in the Langoliers, it was like, oh, this is weird. This is more of a funny at times.
I think here's the problem with the Langoliers. The Langoliers was a short story that was attempted to be adapted into a full-length film or a two-part miniseries.
This is a massive book that was tried to be shortened. How many pages did you say?
His first draft was 700 pages.
Yeah,
that was for a film. He tried as hard as he could to compress it into 130 pages and couldn't.
That's a fun fact we'll get into. But I think what killed the Langoliers for me, I want to jab this in here before we jump into that. What killed it is one, Balky is in it. And I'm sorry, Bronson Pinchot, but you will always forever be one of three characters to me. You will be the psychic weirdo from the movie Second Sight Detective Agency, the guy from Beverly Hills Cop, or Balky Bartokomos. I'm sorry, but you will always be those characters. Trying to do anything else, I just can't see it. So, and not only that, I'm still going to make fun of this. At the end of the Langoliers, when they're walking through the airport, hand in hand, excited that they're back, and the one guy does a jump up, and, like, taps his heels or whatever, and goes, yeah! It's like, why would you add that? Why is that considered a good... Like, no! He does, like, a little traipse, and yahoo! It just killed the momentum. It was just... I couldn't stop laughing about that scene.
Okay, that was a bad scene.
He was this little weenie.
It ruins it at the end.
It's like, okay, they're happy that they survived. I get it. Okay. And wait,
What?
It was supposed to be like a freeze frame.
Yes, that was a bit. So that right there killed whatever horror, the like, not to mention the poor CGI. But I'll let that one go, given the nature of the era that it was made
in. I think it could be possible to do the Langoliers today and have it be done better than
I think so.
And it wouldn't surprise me if they did, considering Amazon just redid this story.
I'd agree with that. But let's get into this story. And we're not going to talk about the Amazon one, by the way. We're not getting into that except for one of maybe in the few snippets. So a few fun facts and fun facts. That's what I call this normally. But in the pre-prep, Thomas looked at me and said, fun?
I think in this case, it's just facts, because some of these facts are not fun in the least.
Yeah, especially when you start comparing it with the book. So first, Scott mentioned one of them already. Stephen King wrote a 700-page script. For those of you that are unaware, the average film script is 120 pages. So he had to condense this considerably. And it was originally tapped to George A. Romero of Walking Dead, not Walking Dead, but Night of the Walking Dead fame, and Dawn of the Dead was supposed to direct it. And that never happened. Probably because he looked at a 700-page script and said, no. Another fun fact, there was the magic 8-ball that they used, and they wanted to figure out how to make that work, but the toy company refused to tell them the secret of how a magic 8-ball works. So they couldn't do that. So, Scott, your turn.
Well, Stephen King's final draft for this ended up being 400 pages, equivalent to 6 hours in length, after Warner Brothers asked him to do a 2-hour script and he just couldn't get it there. And eventually, the final draft for what became The Stand was completed in 1986, and it took 8 more years to get The Stand released as a miniseries. I'll give an actual fun fact, though. There are two actors in here who have roles in Star Trek The Next Generation, and one of them in Next Generation and the same character in Voyager.
It's always about Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. The guy who plays Glenn Bateman plays Boothby in Star Trek The Next Generation, which is Picard's gardener mentor at groundskeeper mentor at Starfleet Academy.
Who was Boothman again?
Boothby?
Yeah.
Who played Glenn Bateman? Last name's Walston.
Okay, who's Glenn Bateman?
The old the sociologist. Sociology.
Oh, my favorite Martian. Got it.
Yes. And he was also in, he's the game master in, which was the B movie that we watched.
Which one?
Which was, we did a month of B movies.
Where you've got it, well, there's an emperor who has everyone playing a game. And he's hiding who he really is till the end, and it's the old man.
Ray Walston.
Ray Walston is who the actor
is. Oh, shoot. How did I forget this? Yep. That's going to bug me now. We did this movie. Yeah.
While you're thinking of that, Max Headroom appeared on Star Trek The Next Generation, and in the Timeless, I believe was the name of it, and he played Berlinghoff or Asmussen. A time-traveling professor who tries to steal stuff from the Enterprise and take it back to the past to invent things. So, there's your Star Trek tie-in for this week.
Alrighty. Speaking of cast, the person who was supposed to play Randall Flagg, well, there were a lot of names tapped for that. Among them, Miguel Ferrer originally wanted to play the role, but Stephen King wanted someone the audience wasn't overly familiar with. Which would make sense for the other people that were tapped. Who was also tapped to be Randall Flagg? Scott, you had a bunch of names.
Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Walken, William Dafoe. Those are just some of them. I think Christopher Walken would have done a really good job as Randall Flagg.
Yep, but unfortunately, King wanted somebody nobody knew, so it wound up being Jamie Sheridan.
We also had James Woods, Lance Hendrickson, and David Bowie. And King wanted Robert Duvall. They ended up going with Jamie Sheridan. And I guess considering all the all-stars you have in the rest of this cast, including Ed Harris and Molly Ringwald, who was big at the time, Gary Sinise, Lieutenant Dan, maybe you had to go with a lesser well-known and well-paid actor to fill this role out.
Yeah. Speaking of actors, the guy who played Nick Andros, Rob Lowe, there was a scene where his head almost gets run over by a car. They filmed that in reverse somehow. And it turns out he was playing the deaf mute. And it turns out he's actually really deaf in his right ear. So I guess that goes something. It's just a fun fact. And another fun fact is that cornfield in the house that Mother Abigail is in. That's a set that they built, obviously, you can tell. But no. It was supposed to be real corn. But by the time they got the corn to set, it was dead. so they had to just make fake corn. So the whole set cost $80,000 because they couldn't get corn on time. Because also, it took so long to film that so many elements they needed, like the guys, things were filmed out of sequence. So the guys who were supposed to look unshaven, they couldn't do it because everything was filmed out of sequence. So it's not like you could just say, all right, we're doing the early stages. Don't shave for a while. Or the early stages shave. And then later on, okay, don't shave anymore because we're at the end here. You've been traveling on, you've been on the road for weeks. They weren't doing that for some God knows reason. And so if you're ever wondering, how come the guys are like clean shaven and nice? Because it was that or looked like they were unshaven wretches the whole time, which just wouldn't make sense. So a lot of things that happen like that or the cornfield are because it was filmed out of sequence. So
I would love to tell you that I was paying attention for things like that. But as someone who has read the book multiple times and seen the documentary multiple times, I was still trying to understand the point of the whole story. Speaking of Mother Abigail, Whoopi Goldberg was originally approached to play Mother Abigail, which she did in the 2020 miniseries that was re-released. But she was approached to play Mother Abigail and turned it down, wasn't available because she was doing Sister Act 2 back in the habit. I'm guessing that she does not regret that choice. The Judge Ferris was originally going to be played by Moses Gunn. It went to Ossie Davis because his wife, Ruby Dee, was playing the role of Mother Abigail, and he was on site, and they decided they'd rather have him as the judge.
Okay.
Poor Moses Gunn. Oh, no, his health had declined, and he died. Whoa, I should have kept reading.
Oh, jeez.
Whoops.
Scott, you might want to read the full fun fact before you start.
Hey, we did say this is fun facts. Oh, yeah. Bobby Boucher's mom is in this. Or Joe Bennett from The Office.
Yeah, who?
She's Ray Flowers, the sarcastic little woman.
Okay, but I don't remember her that much.
She doesn't have a big role.
Yeah, well,
she's on their broadcasting just to get killed by the military.
She shows up in a couple other Stephen King films, and she's the main actress in Misery.
Yeah, she's the one, haven't you heard of Free Speech or whatever, and gets gunned down in the studio? Yeah, live on air.
Oh, yeah. And then, yeah, that's right. She was the DJ, right?
Yep.
And then she wound up being a torturer in the movie Misery.
I love the fact that when they're having her take calls, they get the radio call-in tropes in there, too. Hi, Ray. I just want to say I love your show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's accurate.
Yeah. Listen, I want someone to just call up and be like, hey, Ray, I hate your show. It's terrible. It's horrendous. And this is why I have the number, because I hate it so much. Apparently that with Howard Stern, but man, it's like the sports talk radio tropes. Hey, how you doing, Jim? Longtime Browns fan, 1964, grew up watching my dad. We don't need your resume. Anyway, that's down a rabbit hole. But I just love the fact that they threw that in there for some verisimilitude of to put you in the mood where
right. Well, you're trying to add to it. So
love your show, Ray. Of course, you called.
There's a boatload more of these facts we can go over, but I think we just want to get into this.
Oh, one more.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Stephen King was promised that they would not throw too much standards and practices at him. And one of the things that they fought about was a mummified child doll, the man that is crucified in a cross wearing a crown of drug needles that says drug addict.
They kept that.
And open-eyed corpses. Now, apparently, Nadine's rape scene wasn't argued over. That was okay. But guy hanging on a cross with a crown of drug needles, it says drug addict.
Had to think about that one.
That one we have to fight to get through.
Oh, why is the
incarnation of Satan raping his bride? But, ah, yeah. Go ahead, King.
The 90s, folks. The 90s. Ooh. Now, I should say, too, I guess we'll be nice here and throw this out there. Are there things that are problematic by today's standards? Yes. And I'll give you the one that made me even curl my toes. Well, two. The one would be the rape scene, of course.
Good.
The other one would be, well, what is it? Tom Collins is his name. But
Tom Collins.
But he's always going to be Dauber to me from Coach. Because every time he showed up, I was like, hey, Coach. Hey, Coach. And I was looking for Craig T. Nelson and Luther Vandross to show up. But
M-O-O-N. Spells Dauber.
Spells catch the weenie with Luther Vandross's dog. Yes, that was in a Coach episode. But anyway, he is playing a person with disability. And they're using a lot of more classical terminology to describe that. For example, idiot. And now in the one scene where they use that, they're trying to deliberately be offensive so that because they're using him as a spy for the bad guys. And so they figured, well, if we use an offensive term, the bad guys will think it makes sense because that's who they are. They're bad. But there's just other times where even talking to about Rob Lowe's character, Nick, they call him deaf and dumb, which is something we would not say because even that made me curl my toes like, oh, boy, no, I don't think I was ever keen on the term deaf and dumb. No, that doesn't really work. But so if that stuff bothers you, just be aware. But I think let's throw this out there. I would hope that if you're watching this film or any film prior to, say, 2015, you have to be aware that standards were different. And rather than shutting things down, you just make your own mental note of, boy, that does not translate well. And I'm glad we've moved on from that. And I think that's the healthy way to do that. There's nothing wrong with looking at a previous piece of work and saying, oh, yeah, the things we used to be comfortable with. That's a healthy response.
And but if you disagree with Rage Master here, just realize this. You may be 20, 25 right now and think that your part of your morality is perfect, but your kids will look at things that you did
and call
you and be horrified by it. And you will be considered a conservative, not a progressive liberal anymore.
Right. Things change.
You know? They will and say, Scott, how were you not better? How did you not do more? And how did you let this happen?
And Scott mentions this in a quick rant, and he's right that in the 90s, we thought we had it where it was. We thought we pretty much nailed it. And there was still work to be done, but we thought we achieved the pinnacle and there's nothing more to do.
The 90s were a time when I feel like America got together and lied the late 90s and said, we've ended racism.
Right.
We don't need to do any more work on it.
And so without going too much further in it, I just want you to be aware that the position that I think, and I think I speak for all three of us, that it's a healthy response to say, boy, that just that doesn't go well. You know, seeing a person in blackface, that just doesn't. I know at the time they thought that that was liberating, and maybe for that time it was. Maybe it was given the circumstances. We weren't there. And maybe at the time, calling someone deaf and dumb just felt accurate. And I'm not going to excuse what they did, but what I will say is we have since recognized that, you know what? It doesn't really work.
The right term would have been a deaf mute.
Exactly.
That would have been preferable, but
and,
I mean,
and we've come up with others betters, but the point is we are in no way, by talking about this and mentioning it, we're in no way endorsing it, but we're also not in the position to say, well, that means we just have to smash it, edit it, cancel it, whatever, because it's there. And, you know, you're not going to learn from it if you just say, well, let's just pretend it never happened.
Things still have artistic value. Things still have historical value. You don't
you don't smash a portrait of family life in 15th century Holland because it was a patriarchy.
Right. And there is a difference between taking down statues of Robert E. Lee and pretending Robert E. Lee never existed and not mentioning him in history.
That's ridiculous to do that.
Yes.
So. Anyway, now that we've gotten
Talk about Trash Can Man?
Trash Can Man, somebody might consider that a very bad application. You know, oh, that is a poor depiction of someone with mental illness. And I don't know that. Not being an expert on mental illness, let me give you an example of how maybe that's not necessarily wrong. Just this week in my hometown, a schizophrenic individual, well, probably schizophrenic individual, was off his meds and got let out of whatever hospital he was in for being okay. And he saw demons everywhere, saw his 6-year-old son being one of those demons, and clubbed him to death with a baseball bat. I'm not joking. Google it. And this just happened this week. And to sit there,
4 streets from the house that I grew up on, and
right,
Mark, you lived a street over at one or 2 streets.
Correct.
Over at one point.
And so this is an individual who most likely will be put into a facility, I hope. But these kind of things, when a film depicts that, then is it really, given the varied nature of mental illness? We don't want to make light of it or make a joke or make it sound like, ha, 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 how funny. That's not the goal here. And you should never do that. But to say that any depiction is wrong, well, that's, you know, of course, it's silly to watch him run around going bum dee bum dee bum dee bum dee. But at the same time, couldn't there be someone like that?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we need to realize that the plot called for him to have that type of mental illness. It doesn't mean that everyone with a mental illness acts like that.
It's not like he was lauded for it.
No.
Towards the end, people wanted him dead because they recognized this guy's a threat. And I'm not saying we should kill him. I'm not endorsing that. But it's not like anybody was. It's not like anybody was walking around going, "Oh, there's that guy again." No, it wasn't like that at all. It was actually, if you think about it, they were abusing him. Because they were using his obsession with fire and explosives to arm jet fighters.
Yeah, I'll be interesting to see what the interpretation of Trash Can Man in the new Stand miniseries is.
I don't know how you could do too much more without sandbagging the story.
Yeah.
Because you need him to be a pyromaniac. And also, there's something sad about that character in that, remember, he's constantly battling the voices of what he used to put up with. You know, we're going to send you up to the home in Terre Haute. We're going to do this to you. You're a piece of trash. And this, when you hear these voices, it's like, this isn't funny. This is partially what might have contributed to him being the way he is. For all we know, he was born a perfectly mentally healthy person. Maybe had an inkling and this pushed him over the edge. We don't know his backstory exactly, at least from the film, maybe the book with its 2000 page count or whatever obnoxious amount that George R. R. Martin could never possibly achieve. Maybe it explains what put him in his position. But you're not put in a position in this film to say, oh boy, what a good guy. Because even when they first introduce him and he gets excited about blowing up that oil tank, he starts hearing Randall Flagg trying to recruit him, calling him the Trash Can Man and using the voices in his head, the taunts. I mean, he's abusing the guy. It's to the point where even Randall Flagg at the end says, if you see him, kill him and make it quick and painless. I have a special place in my heart for him. Even the devil's like, oh, this poor guy.
You know, it had to take a lot of professionalism for him to be able to read that line in the serious delivery that he gave it. Trash Can Man, I will set you high in my kingdom and set you to burn. Like, how do you start with Trash Can Man and stay just dead in character with it? But I had to ask you if we talked about Trash Can Man, because when you called Tom Collins, my brain did a jump and went to Tom Jones, and I started hearing, it's not unusual, and seeing the Carlton dance in my head.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know, with the star-studded cast we have, I'm surprised Tom Jones didn't make an appearance, because you almost wonder, when they made this, were people signing up? Or Scott, you or Thomas brought up, how did he manage? What kind of dirt did Stephen King have on these people that he could get them in? You know, Rob Lowe. Hey, Rob, I'd like you to do this part. And if he says, I don't know, remember that thing I know I can write about? When does filming start, Stephen? So.
I based the character of Harold Lauder off of you, Rob.
So.
You better. Yeah, I think you want to be in tomorrow. We'll start recording.
Yeah. Makeup's at 5 a.m. So. I typically, this is the part of the show where I would go into the plot. For 4 hours, I'm going to give you just this. A super flu called Captain Trip, which is named after a member of the Grateful Dead, is let out of an experimental facility in California, and one guy grabs his family and drives out of there before they're quarantined in. And he makes it all the way to Arnett, Texas in the east, in East Texas, Arnett, where he and his family die off, and the super flu spreads from there, and only a handful of select people survive. And in the long run, you find out that it's a fight between good and evil. Randall Flagg represents the devil trying to take over everything, and Mother Abigail is fighting for God to gather all these people up and take us to a final showdown where evil loses. I think that's about all you need to know. And it's the super flu that kills everybody, which is why it falls into this category. But is this really a science fiction movie? I mean, yeah, with the super flu, but the problem is it's a Stephen King story, which means it doesn't fall into any real good category, because he's just writes about whatever warped thing enters his head. I mean, really, I know he's supposed to be a horror writer, or I've heard, but every time I read a book from him or watch a film, it's like, this isn't really scary as much as it is just weird. I mean, data chunk, a giant crab lobster that walks on a beach going data chunk. I think just Cujo. These are just weird stories. It's scary in that, oh my gosh, a super flu that killed all these people. And of course, the book I Am Legend inspired this, no doubt. But it's just weird. That's all I can say. And that's why it falls in the category. But what kind of themes or rips and picks do we want to jump into here? Because I would say the one pick theme I'll give is societal collapse. Really. If that many people died that fast, it would look that bad. Although I never understood how they had trouble starting cars and getting anywhere. It's like you're surrounded by cars. Just pick one. Odds are, and well, there's not enough gas in it. Then siphon out of the 50 cars surrounding you.
My problem is that the roads are all too open at some point, even outside of the major cities.
Well, come on, that makes sense. If you're in the middle of Nebraska, where there's nobody anyway.
Well, I mean, there's a reason why they're riding bikes most of the time and they're not always in cars, because look, the roads haven't been cleared, but I get that. I think one of the themes in this is mankind is a herd animal. All that Stephen King portrays in The Stand is that we're trying to get back into a society, back into a city, and to have that protection against violent death in the wilderness. And that's probably one of the reasons why humanity is so successful as a species, because we do know how to work together, pool our resources, and get security against starvation and security against attack and security against weather by pooling Mother Nature, everything, by pooling our resources together and existing in that society.
Well, doing that also allows specification. I mean, let's be honest, if you're living on a farm, basically growing your food, you're not going to take the time or have the time to learn how to make a car.
Right. No, absolutely.
Right. You're hoping to get enough people of all types of skill sets to be able to reform that society too. Mm-hmm. I also think Stephen King is showing you a very watered down thing, though, that not everybody wants to live in the same type of society. We have a different idea how these societies should work. Mm-hmm. The Boulder Free Zone is almost a pure democracy.
Yeah, but we also have to consider...
Whereas Flag is an autocracy.
The supernatural element here, that Mother Abigail is what brought them all together, and they all just instinctively want to work together, except for the guy Parker Lewis, who it turns out Parker Lewis can lose. Props to you if you get that reference. But who's the sick perv that's after Molly Ringwald?
Harold Lauder.
Yeah, Harold Lauder. He's the exception, but then again, he's a sick freak to begin with in the movie. In the book, he's even worse. We'll spare you the details.
Just realize it's King, so that's enough.
Yeah, there's some things in there that just that guy. I get why Molly Ringwald's character does not want to be with him.
Here's the true reason that Stephen King is a master of horror. It's not because he scares you. It's because in every single book he writes, he leaves you with an image that you wish you could gouge out of your brain, but you can't.
But the problem is, too,
thanks,
the
King.
Character is very believable. When we were reading up on Harold Lauder's character, and it's like, yeah, there's people like that. There are people like that, and for all I know, they live next door to me. That's disturbing. That, in fact, just consider the character of Harold Lauder. He's got a thing for Molly Ringwald. And anybody that so much as looks at her askance is his enemy. Because despite her insisting, no way, no chance, no how, he thinks, well, who cares what she thinks? I'm the guy and she should listen to me. And when he does get hooked up with Nadine, who is Randall Flagg's harlot of Babylon, let's say, he abuses her. She submits to him fully, and he still abuses her to the point where even she's feeling upset. In fact, we could talk about Nadine. She's interesting. She starts out full of life and attractive, and as things go on, the more she sees Randall Flagg, the more her hair turns gray, the more older she looks, the more ill she looks. It's that evil is taking away from her. So, and that's a good depiction. That's a good theme because... Scott, you mentioned that it's more autocracy, democracy. We see that where the evil guy is running the autocracy and sucking the life out of people like Nadine, and Mother Abigail is giving people hope back, their life back. And it is something of a democracy that they're still trying to hash out, but there's this general desire to work on it.
It also does surprise me that the message Stephen King gives you is that the Boulder Free Zone is the better community, because I was thinking about this right now. It's not just a good versus evil, democracy versus dictatorship. It's religious versus secular. Randall Flagg is the secular society. He's not trying to build a religion there. Now, he is the devil, but it's not, you know, God is out of that society.
He's letting them do whatever they want. Really.
Mother Abigail is a stand-in for God. She's Moses. She even says, I'm too old to be leading the Israelites out of the desert.
Yeah.
And it uses religion. Religion is what pulls them all together. Mm-hmm. Reverence of Mother Abigail is what pulls them all together.
And that's interesting because what's it, Larry Underwood? Even he is doubtful about God, but he sees the value of Mother Abigail.
And it's like saying, much like through the medieval times, religion becomes the framework for state. And I don't know if Stephen King is trying to just make a comment that in any developing state, a religion is the easiest way to form a cohesive moral framework for your society and to get people to buy into a cultural identity, or if he's actually trying to say that religion is a power unto itself, and that if he's trying to make a positive message about religion and a truthful message, or is he simply trying to say that it is a great organizing principle and framework?
Well, given other depictions of the church he has shown in other works, like if you go back to The Lawnmower Man, another film with a person with a mental developmental disability. Interesting. But the priest in that movie is horrible. He is the enemy. So I don't know. And then, of course, if you look at the film's Needful Things, you have the Protestant and the Catholic fighting it out. But at the end of the day, they're both horrible in their own right. The Catholic is a greedy jerk and the Protestant has a sexual addiction. And they just, in the end, they're fighting each other to the death. Kind of, that would be an obvious Protestant Catholic fight. So I don't know if he's being pro-religion or just pointing out the flaws in those films. So I don't know. That's a good question, Scott. I don't know, based on his other work. I'd have to see an interview with him. And I haven't done that, but Sickies, you can comment later if you want.
In this case, this is all about the supernatural. This case is, I mean, it's hard to tell because he has the hand of God come out and detonate the A-bomb.
With both the guys who are left, I guess you could say the prophets, if you will, chained up saying, take us home, Mother Abigail, take us home. They know that they're about to die, but they're okay with it because they know heaven awaits. So, yeah, vaporize us. Go ahead. Which, obviously, there's reference to Revelation there because they were one of the final two prophets that walked into, well, I guess Vegas is the stand-in for the Valley of Armageddon. I don't know, but they were the final two prophets. Four went out, but only two made it to the end. And if you read Revelation, in the end, two prophets come out to warn against the end.
You know, I think this is where I want to start a rip. Is that okay?
Whatever.
Stephen King sometimes is notorious for not knowing how to end his stories. And this makes no sense. The four of you have to go to Las Vegas. Why? Because you do. You got to do something important there. Okay?
And the stand. Take your stand.
Go there and stand. Why? So I can witness the hand of God and Mother Abigail's voice come detonate a nuke? I didn't need to be here. Trash Can Man was going to bring that back. You needed three of your people sacrificed to die to pull this trick off? God is demanding human sacrifice now? The closest that happened was with Abraham and Isaac, and God called it off. But this time, in an apocalypse, after killing 99% of the planet, God needs three people to die to show his power?
I suppose, if I can play devil's advocate here.
Buddy!
their execution and bringing together grouped that nation, that Antichrist nation together, maybe that was the necessity? Because their capture caused Randall Flagg to bring everyone out to witness their execution. And by having everyone there, not only could they see the hand of God at work, but also realize we're dead.
But it's a nuke.
Maybe that was the purpose, that to bunch everyone together to eradicate that evil nation. And the only way to do it was to bring out two targets that everyone was going to be there to witness the end demise. I guess it's like a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thing. God spared them from the fiery furnace only after Nebuchadnezzar brought everybody out to bow down to this statue. Maybe it was that, but that's a stretch.
Yeah, I just, if you didn't kill them with a nuke. You killed them with a nuke. You don't need everybody.
You don't need everyone together
place.
If they're in the same vicinity.
I just wish King would have given them something important to do. You know?
Well, yeah.
Even their power joining together, allowing the summoning of Mother Abigail.
Or all our powers together.
Right.
Form Captain Planet.
Captain Planet. He's the worst superhero. Going to take pollution up to 1,000,000.
Throw a garbage bag at him, quick.
He's our powers magnified, unless you can throw trash at him, because that's his weakness. I'm fighting pollution. What's your weakness? Pollution.
Wait a minute.
Are you fighting pollution?
That's like, Batman, I'm here to fight crime, but if I'm near a criminal, I panic and break down and can't do anything. So you're fighting crime by just saying crime. Are you basically McGruff the crime dog? You just
no,
show up and
it would almost
kids?
Be like Superman. What's your weakness? Oxygen.
Yeah.
Oh, so in other words, you're useless on this planet.
Gravity. Now, like if I wanted to kill Captain Planet, I'd just get super soakers loaded up with toxic waste.
Well, you don't even need that. Honestly, you just need
dirty water.
You need a, oh, look, I fit it. Here's my, here's Scott's millionth and one Diet Dr. Pepper can. Oh, sorry, Mountain Dew can. I'll throw it at him.
Yeah.
He's done.
Just make sure you put some junk in it so he can't go, that's recyclable. It would be if I hadn't put that needle in it.
Hey, Captain Planet, look, I'm mixing recyclables with perishables.
Oh, no.
Anyway, we should just do an episode.
I feel the great disturbance in the pollution.
You know what? We need to make like a side rant knocking Captain Planet. So, but, oh, yeah. So I guess that would be the only thing I could come up with as to why they were put forward, because it would make sense if their prayers brought down God's hand of judgment, or if maybe they were sent as a final warning for people. You can still leave. You can still flee Randall Flagg. And that's what their goal was. You're right. That would make a lot more sense than just bringing everyone together. Because again, a nuke, well, as long as they're within an X amount of radius, they're dead.
Well, this is Stephen King. Let's be honest. This is Stephen King is really good at making horror at times, but he also puts supernatural elements in everything.
Yeah, and sometimes it just doesn't even make sense. Like, why would
Let's be honest. What? How many times have we gone through Stephen King's books, movies, whatever, and by the end we are more confused than we started with.
The Langoliers is a great example. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, it can be it.
I was thinking Pennywise as well. Yeah.
It's an interdimensional alien thingamabob that's not weak, but weak. And what?
It starts out scary, like, ooh, killer clown. That's freaky. But then, later on, it's like, wait, this is a spider alien dimension thing? Wait, what?
But
huh?
He's alien, but he's not alien because it's in a dimension.
So it's like you started off this way and it was going well. Then halfway through, you're like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to lean onto this killer clown thing anymore. I really want to write an alien story now. So here's how I'm going to do that. I wonder if he writes that way, where he starts off one way and then decides, I want to do something else. And then he spends 50 to 100 pages morphing it, and then goes all in and leans in on that.
Well, I mean, considering how much he writes and how fast he writes, it's very possible.
That's true.
But, I mean, let's be honest. This is the problem that even a 700-page script will have when you go, let's take a book that is going to confuse anyone and everyone.
Yeah.
And then try to somehow condense a massive book down to 400 pages?
Yeah.
And then and not confuse anyone?
And then do a 120-page script.
I was confused, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. There were definite moments of, well,
what? You got a six-hour movie that is not long enough to tell this tale, but is also too long to tell the tale.
Yes. You know what? It reminds me very much of we're not going to go down this path, but the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League, it took you 4 hours to do this, and someone thought that was going to wind up in a movie theater. No. Guys, I'm glad it got made, but Zack Snyder sycophants, this four and a half hour cut was not making it to theaters. And he was wholly incapable of editing anything out. And if you do edit out, it loses. Actually, no, you could edit out a good 20 to 30 minutes of slow-mo waste. But so this is Stephen King. There were a lot of things I'm sure we could have edited out. But in order to get his ringing endorsement, we had to pad it with
everything.
Yeah, just the scenes. This is a rip. The scenes where Mother Abigail is sitting on her porch, Amazing Grace. Look, I get it. She's God's servant. I don't need to see her doing that. there are just moments of her talking to the camera as God. And it's like, is there any purpose to this? I get it. She's God's prophet. I get it. I don't need to watch her singing the old rugged cross.
Lord, those prunes did the trick.
Yes, that's another one.
I do not think...
I need to know that?
How helpless is Mother Abigail if God has to tell her to eat some prunes to get rid of your constipation?
Yeah, why do I need to see her walking out of the outhouse, talking about her lack of bowel movement, sit down, pick up a guitar, and do the old rugged cross? Of what value is there?
Who wants to know that a 106-year-old woman just took a crap in an outhouse?
Also, who wants to know that apparently your prophet is so dependent on God's words that won't even eat a prune without...
Yes!
I imagine that's how this prayer went, you know? Abby, come on now. You can figure this one out. I'm kind of fighting the apocalypse here. I will speak to you. I don't have time to tell you to eat prunes.
What, you know, oh, prunes, that's it. I'm sorry. I dementia and everything. Thank you, God. Prunes.
As a Christian, I can say this is biblically the case. I do not need to ask God for every little decision I make in my life. When I wake up in the morning and need to decide, let's see, do I have toast or not today? I don't need to go, oh, dear Lord, do I have toast or not? God's not going to answer that.
Lord.
I guess he could, but will he?
Toast?
Odds
plain
are not.
Toast or butter? God, I'm going to leave it to your will. If the butter magically flies out of the fridge and lands on the toast, I should have had it with butter.
Well, and the funny part is then people start getting into that notion where I open the fridge and the butter happens to accidentally fall out of it. So I take that as God's divine intervention when it's like, no, you just didn't put it in the fridge well.
Yeah, if you're looking for a sign from God hard enough, chances are you will find that sign for whatever you're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, those are some slow moments with Mother Abigail. And then there's the scene, and maybe it's described in the book well, when she just decides
to
leave Boulder. Just leave.
Because she sinned of the sin of pride.
I see.
And she doesn't hear God at that point. She's cut off.
So she leaves. And then comes back looking like she had been beaten with a rubber hose and just enough to tell people get out of the house because Parker Lewis is going to blow it up after listening to his disco. And it works
because rock and roll isn't the music of the devil. Disco is.
Yeah. Might be onto something there.
Might be the reason why we got rid of disco.
Yeah. You might be onto something there actually. So, yeah. And then that kills Rob Lowe's character. You know,
Nick
what
Andros.
Yeah, Nick Andros. You know, we ripped on here. I'll throw out a pick with the scene where they decide they have to send spies to see if Boulder's gonna, or not Boulder, but Vegas is gonna arm up. And they decide, well, we could send Tom because who would suspect him? But they realize we're going to have to hypnotize him. And so they first convince him, oh, yeah, yeah, when we do this to you, you do fun tricks like standing on your head. And he's like, oh, okay. And then they get him, they hypnotize him and tell him what to do. But they hate it. They're like, first of all, the fact that they're doing this, the one guy said, let's see, we've been a committee for a week and we're already turning into the CIA.
I have many jokes there, but I'll leave it.
But then while they're hypnotizing Tom, you can tell they don't like it. They don't feel good about what they're doing. Like the judge they send and the other woman, they're completely cognizant of what they're doing, aware and willing. That's fine. But Tom, it's like, oh, I mean, this is the perfect agent, but we do not feel good about it.
Well, I mean, again, this is the thing about Stephen King. He's good at creating scenes. He's good at creating elements.
Yeah.
Just sometimes when he does scenes and elements, either you don't want to remember them. Thank you so much for some of those scenes, King. Or it doesn't make sense. It's a great scene. He sets the scene up. Just at the end of it,
You don't know what happened.
Yeah, they don't transfer well to film. They really don't.
They never do. Let's be honest. His books never transfer well to film.
No. I mean, then they tried to remake It. They're trying to remake The Stand. The remake of It, I wasn't very happy with.
I thought it was okay.
It was okay.
It was okay, but it wasn't fantastic.
I've never seen a Stephen King movie or film adaptation that I liked more than the Stephen King book. And I think a lot of it is because Stephen King comes up with the psychological stuff that you're only hearing inside the character's head.
Yes.
A lot of stuff that he writes for that type of mindscape rather than to visually, you know?
Right. His writing has this ability to A, get inside the character's head. So you're hearing thoughts and ideas from the character that, again, does not transfer to film. And also, it works better when it's in your mind. Let's be honest, Langoliers. Yeah. My mind came up with a lot better things than the CGI did.
Yeah, he works better with tell, not show. And film is show, don't tell. And it's a challenge for him. He's a magnificent writer. One of the best of his generation. He's a prolific writer, and he manages to create unique characters in every situation.
Yeah.
But it's often too big of a story to tell on the big or little screen.
And let's be honest with this one, when he comes up with a virus and kills everyone off.
I'm going to say from the first moment that I watched The Stand, it is always kind of like it's stuck in my head. It's never not stuck in my head because the idea of the flu mutating like that is not impossible.
No.
It's a matter of time before we get another very, very deadly flu. And it's a matter of when, not if the flu mutates. It might take 100 years or 300 years. But I will say that this film, like I always sat around. What stuck in my head was if a pandemic like that ever happened, you know, you just wait around. Do you get sick? Wondering if it's going to be you. Wondering when it's going to hit you. And you kind of have a new appreciation of this movie after what we went through in the last year, at least in the fact of how quickly it would spread. I mean, if COVID was as deadly as Captain Trips, I mean, it would be a very similar situation.
Yeah. Also, I mean, even the beginning, you go, oh, escape from a weapons lab. Pretty close to what we think happened.
It's
like, let's be honest. Something happened. It got around. And now we're sitting here in the studio a year later, finally seeing each other.
This could be a whole side debate, but I believe that it's like any other coronavirus or pathogen that found a way to jump from, just a Star Trek term, pathogen. any other Star Trek virus that jumps from animals to humans. It happens.
Well,
you get a mutation that allows it to spread from the animal to the human. I don't think COVID was developed in a lab. I think it was something that just crossed over and found its way. It probably did start in a wet market, but it found its way out of an animal and a strain of the disease. It's like mad cow disease.
Like in
we gave
like
it to the cows.
Film, like in the film Contagion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But
again, we don't 100% know where this started, but this is the thing about the film. We know where it started.
Yeah.
In a weapons lab.
And we know it got where it was a much bigger super flu because it was engineered.
Correct. And this was a... let's be honest, this was, I mean, the book was at least written during the Cold War.
It's
no, it was after the Cold War. It was just
77.
Oh, the book.
No,
you're right.
I'm
the
sorry,
book.
Sorry,
the book.
I'm sorry,
the
right,
book.
You're right. You're right.
Yes. The movie came out at the, but no, the book was in the middle of the Cold War.
That's right.
So let's be honest, germ research was absolutely
for sure. I mean, it's still going on, but it definitely was.
Well, I mean, the scary thing is to find out there was a Soviet defector at nearing the end of the Cold War, and we found out what some of the Soviets were doing, and it's like, it's scary to know what was being experimented with and tested, and let's be honest, we were doing the same thing, just not to the, I think, the same degree, but...
Well, and it wasn't new. If you go back to World War II, the Japanese and China were making disease bombs.
Well,
experimenting. I forget the name of the camp, but they had a camp where they were manufacturing viruses, subjecting the local population to it.
I can't remember the unit designation.
Yeah, unit something. And they would literally then drop disease bombs on Chinese villages that they thought had KMT fighters.
Well, this is the other thing. Since basically the beginning of time, germ warfare has been used. I mean,
throwing middle dead bodies into middle a well.
Yeah, it's smallpox victims being thrown over walls during sieges. Yeah. I mean, we have always used germ warfare, and even, I mean, they don't want to say we do anymore, but let's be honest, we still use... It's a different type of germ warfare, as much as it's now, well, we have the vaccines for this thing. If you want the vaccine, you play nice with America and not... You give us a good, favorable trade deal or something.
Other countries that have it, yeah.
Yeah, but...
Mostly developed, pretty much.
Yeah, the developed world, let's be honest, plays God with the rest of the world. But this is the thing. This movie came up with a premise that wasn't too crazy. Especially for King. Let's be honest. For King, this is a...
That's a fairly conventional way to knock out the end of the world.
Yeah, for King, wow. A virus engineered. Okay, King, you actually got something practical and realistic.
Instead of a clown crab crawling out of the ocean leading an army of snow crab laser barfers, this is
pretty tame.
This is pretty believable, actually.
Right. And okay. Now, of course, you also have the end of the world and a whole bunch of God's servant and the devil, and all this supernatural stuff, which King always puts in.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, let's be honest. King probably couldn't write a birthday card without somehow putting,
yeah,
happy birthday. By the way, the devil's going to kill you.
Yeah.
What?
The devil's in this card.
What?
You'll see.
Happy birthday. 33 years ago, R.F., the demon, assumed human form and put his seed in your mother. And you have now come of age to receive his legacy. Prepare to die.
In the background, you hear like the music from The Omen. Wow, this is the worst birthday ever.
I know. Now for a 7-hour ordeal before your death.
Yes, it will be most terrible. So I think we're clocking up on the hour here. So I think we've got about that point to rate this thing. Unless anybody's got a final thing they need to chuck out there.
I think we've gone over this film pretty extensively.
Okay.
I think we should rate this and figure out, where do we place this film?
Yeah. So.
Oh, I guess. Tough mini series?
Yeah. Well, film mini series.
Ravens? Trash can men?
Ooh, how many ravens?
Cornfields?
Yeah. How many ravens? Yeah, because the...
Ravens, yeah, the kind of main thing.
Was,
yeah.
Was Randall Flags flying around. So, yeah, sure. How many ravens you want to give it?
You know, this one's a hard one to rate, but I'm going to go with the Scott scale putting a 5 as average. I'm going to call this film a 6.5. It's got some good ideas. It has good concepts. The apocalypse, disease, famine, pestilence, religion, good versus evil, a lot of good character work and development. It's missing anything that makes it action-packed and exciting. Like, the most drama is the old man going to fall and break his leg going down the hill? No, it's the younger guy who's going to break his leg going up the hill. There's not a whole lot of drama as far as, like, action drama, and the pacing lags, and that's you know... It's a hard one to watch. Mm-hmm. It is a hard one to watch. It's not that it's a bad film, but after 6 hours of watching this, you want it to be over. And then, I'm sorry, but Stephen King did not give us an ending that actually works for me. Mm. It's an anticlimactic ending. As I said, there's no reason story-wise to have them there. So I'll give it a 6.5.
At least they don't do a stupid skip up at the end going, yeah!
True. Okay, I'm going to give it... I'm thinking a 5, okay? I'm giving it a 5 because of the slowness of it. I mean, again, it has good ideas. It got good premise in some areas. But it is so slow at times. It is mind-numbing. If you know what you're getting into, okay? And this is what I'm saying. If you know you're getting into a slow ordeal at times, and you know what is here, I think it makes it a little better. But if you don't know what you're walking into, oh, I feel sorry for you, because you probably are not going to be able to watch this.
Yeah.
And I don't know if today's generation can get through this. that the attention span that is required for this is a lot longer.
For sure.
And I just cannot bump it past a 5. It's good. It has redeeming qualities. But it's confusing as hell at times.
Mm.
And it is long. So, 5.
Yeah, I'm going to give it about a 6 as well. I was going to say 6 or 7, but no, 6 now that I think about it. There's a lot of good themes, but I'm going to... I forget who I saw online talk about this when he reviewed Midsommar and said the problem with a lot of films nowadays is that we mistake theme for good storytelling. It's got a lot of good themes. You have to like it. But theme do not a good story make. If that were the case, then anybody could be a good storyteller. But the themes help. They do. And the acting is, except for Molly Ringwald's character, the acting is good. All-star cast. You have a plausible scenario, but it loses points for one. And honestly, too, as the story progresses, I can enjoy more of it. But Thomas, to your point, that's because I'm used to films. I'm used to sitting down for a slow burn at times. Not always. Sometimes I get bored because of the modern movies. But it's an interesting point even my father has made. Movies today are designed to induce a headache. They are designed to do a lot of flash panning. A lot of this, because this belief that if there's a lot of flash panning, you think it's great and there's action and it keeps your attention. But it's actually ruining your attention span. Because what happens to you is when there isn't flash panning, you can't stay focused. Because your mind has been programmed to be ready for the next or jump scare or whatever the heck. And so if you're watching this, there are no jump scares, or maybe there's a few, but there's not like there is today where the horror movies are all just jump scare. And it's a slow burn. It's a slow build.
It's a Stephen King. It's literally it.
But it's also just the way stories were told. Go back to the Dark Phoenix saga in the comics. Originally, that story was a slow build. Now, Dark Phoenix is whipped out in the first 5 minutes of any comic story. Because we just don't have time to wait for that. We need flash pans and action and fire. We need it now. And if I'm not all hyped up on sugar, oh my God, this is a good story.
Well, again... Casablanca.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't remake that because people today, they'd have to add action and suspense and throw in some modern themes because we always have to translate it for modern day for some God knows reason instead of just saying, well, let's make something new.
Right, and I get what you're saying here. This film, for its time, was good.
Right.
And I agree with you in so many ways.
But there's still slowness. I mean, the YouTube version I found, there was part 2, I think I want to say, was boring. Even for me, it was like, okay. I was about ready to text you guys, never again are we doing a long Stephen King anything. Had it not picked up in part 3 the way they in Betrayal, I would have said never again. If we're doing another Stephen King thing, it's in a 2-hour movie. I am not doing this again. But after it picked up, I softened because it started getting better. Once it got to part 3, 1 is interesting. 2 is the first half of part 1 is good. Then it gets dry until you get to about the middle of part 3.
Yeah.
And that is a drawback. And just some of the other things we talked about that are there that you really don't need to be there. But Stephen King, just like Zack Snyder or Scott, whatever his name is, Snyder, just can't let go of his baby.
Well, here's the thing. We all rated this as a decent film.
Yeah.
We have not.
It's worth your time.
We have not attacked this thing, said this is the worst thing ever.
No.
We are not saying anything. We're just.
Not at all.
We're warning you.
We're ready.
We're letting you know. It's worth a watch. We think it's good. Just be aware. that it's long,
mm-hmm.
confusing,
mm-hmm.
and drawn out.
Yep. All those things.
So, we are recommending this, just warning.
We're recommending it with an asterisk next to it. So, there you go. And of course, there's the Amazon one you're welcome to go see, but we're not going to review that one.
No, I think I am going to see it because I think it's a better way to tell this story. It allows you to, we said that it's too long and too short at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Breaking that down into hour or so chunks allows you to tell this story in the length of time you need to do the character work that you need
mm-hmm.
without
mm-hmm.
it being too long.
Of course, here's the other thing. You sickies can let us know what you guys think.
Exactly.
And tell us if you think the new series is better than the old series at
www.brideofsaintandrandallflag. No, ravinglunaticmedia.com. That's ravinglunaticmedia.com. Ravinglunaticmedia.com.
So,
what's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay sick, sickies.